Defying strict communist security measures, they flew themselves, their families and a score of unsuspecting miners into West Germany. Their success brought them freedom and new lives in the West. However, it also hastened the crackdown on any former RAF pilots still remaining in Czechoslovakia. Tom McEncrow has more.
It had been just over 2 years since the communists staged their successful coup d'état in 1948. During that time, they had already begun arresting individuals suspected of Western ties, among them RAF war heroes Air Marshal Karel Janoušek and Major Josef Brix. However, another group had until now been more lucky. With a serious shortage of pilots, the communists had to employ them to fly the country's civilian aircraft on intrastate flights until a new generation of pilots loyal to the regime could be trained. Among this group were former RAF airmen Ladislav Svetlík, Oldřich Doležal and Vít Angeter. These three hatched a plan in which they would take advantage of the fact that all three of their flights were headed to Prague at the same time on March 24, 1950. During the 2 months of planning that preceded the action, they told dozens of people about their idea, including family members, Czech airline staff and fellow former RAF service members. Last but not least, they discussed the route of their escape in Prague's airport cafe the day before the action. Historian Martin Ulrich told Czech Radio why their scheming seems to have gone under the radar of the communist secret police.
It is important to state that while it was 2 years after the 1948 takeover, communist security services were still under construction. The initial violence took place under the leadership of the communist-controlled Defense Intelligence Service. That had since been purged, with some of its leaders ending up on the gallows and others sentenced to prison. As far as the Air Force was concerned, it was still outfitted with old-fashioned piston engine planes. Soviet MIGs with jet engines were yet to be delivered.
The pilots managed to smuggle their families and some of their old friends from the RAF onto the flights as well. Their wives used their maiden names so as not to arouse suspicion. However, not all on board were anticipating a great escape, says historian Martin Ulrich.
For the plane which was headed from Bratislava, it was easy as all of the crew and passengers were planning to get into the West. When it comes to the flights that took off from Brno and Ostrava, it was different. Only a part of those on board knew about the plan. For example, on board the plane from Ostrava, Ladislav Svetlík was the only one of the four-man crew who knew about the action. He tied up the hands of the others with parachute strings to give them an alibi in case they returned to Prague and were investigated by the communist police.
The unsuspecting passengers, which included a mining delegation from Ostrava that believed it was headed for a conference in Prague, only found out where they were once the planes landed in Erding Airport, West Germany. In the end, of the 85 people who ended up on the other side of the Iron Curtain, 27 decided to stay. The rest returned to Czechoslovakia. The escape shocked the communist paper Rudé Právo, which wrote that the whole action used, I quote, gangster methods that must have been inspired by foreign influences, end quote. And the action warranted the production of a communist propaganda film depicting the events 2 years later. New measures were also put in place, which included the presence of an armed policeman in civilian dress during all flights and the obligation for pilots to report their location every 10 minutes. Meanwhile, the remaining RAF pilots in Czechoslovakia faced a new series of persecutions.
Report was by Tom McEncrow. Now, in the final part of our programme today, here's another chance to hear an interview that I did with Prague violin maker Jan Spidlen. Jan Spidlen is the fourth generation of his family to work as a master violin maker. But what are some of the secrets to crafting top-class violins? And how has the industry changed in the last few decades? I discuss those questions with Spidlen, surrounded by an array of traditional tools at his Prague Centre workshop. But I began by asking him about the first ever violin that he produced.
That was back in 1986, so I was 21. I made the violin while I was still finishing my secondary school in Prague as a woodcarver. And I already spent some time in the workshop with my father, so he basically told me what to do. But before that, I spent 1 year in a violin-making school in Germany, so I already had the basics.
And you also worked or studied in London?
Yes. Well, after I finished the secondary school, then I spent about a year with my father, and then I went to London to work with a very nice company with very fine violins.
Tell us about the story of your family. I understand you are the fourth generation of Spidlens who have made violins.
Yes, that's correct. My great-grandfather was the first.
And his name was František, and he was working in the late 19th century making violins.
Yes, he was born 1867, 100 years before I was born. And he was not from Prague originally, he was from the Giant Mountains. And then that was a very poor country. Then he had a chance to go to a better place, to Russia. First to Kiev, which is Ukraine, then later to Moscow. And he made really a fabulous career there. He achieved the highest position in Tsarist Russia. He became the violin maker of the Tsarist Conservatory in Moscow.
Tell us what happened with your family's business under communism.
Well, those were difficult times, of course. My grandfather, who was a successful dealer, not only maker, but a dealer. So he owned this whole house and a large store. And of course, the communists took all this from him and he suffered a lot. So he died in depressions, and that was quite difficult. Only what remained for our profession was one room, one little workshop in the basement of this house, where my father spent most of his years. It was not allowed to make any business, any dealing, but production, making new instruments was allowed. So that was what he became focused on. Luckily, actually, because he got very good in it.
Also, I saw a fabulous video of you when you were like 4 years old or something in the workshop with him.
Well, yes, I was growing up on the first floor, where was my parents' apartment, and so it was just a few steps to go to the workshop. So I spent quite a lot of time with my father.
On your website, there are photos of four violins made by you, your father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. To me, they all look the same. Are they exactly the same?
No, of course not. You must train your eye a bit to tell the differences, but they are quite different.
What are the differences?
Well, many. Really many. It's the same as if you look at cars, then for someone who has never seen car, they are all the same. But once you know, you can tell.
But isn't there still a kind of classic violin shape and design that doesn't really change very much?
Well, we basically use the classical models, Stradivari, Guarneri, Amati. And based on this, you still try to show your own style, your own, let's say, handwriting. It's more about detail, and it's more about varnish quality, the wear of varnish, the care, how precise you can work, or you want to work. Some violin makers don't like to be precise, or they cannot be precise, but still they make very nice instruments. And of course, there is the sound quality.
What role does varnish play in a violin? Because I was reading that your father developed his own varnish.
Yes, well, I also tried to develop my own one. It's a job for many years, because you see the results after many years. You can judge the varnish, you get the feedback after many years. A violin is made for a long time. It was my father's hobby, or his passion to make his own varnish, and he made many tests. And so I I inherited this a bit. It's a very wide field to work on, and there are many books written on Val and Varnish, so it's a lot of fun too.
And you've said in the past that your aim when you're making a violin is for it to sound better in 100 years than it does now. But how do you attempt to achieve that?
Well, this comes from the construction of a violin. It's constructed, it's designed so cleverly that it really improves in time. It needs some technically said stress, or, you know, it needs to get a bit tired. The wood needs to get a bit tired to vibrate best. So then we say the violin is getting to be played in. It improves in time.
Does that mean that a top violin player wouldn't play a brand new violin? They prefer an older one?
Well, they mostly do prefer old violins, but even a new one can equal the old ones if it's made very well. But still, even the new one will improve in time.
And what's the difference between an average violin and a great one?
big difference. You judge the sound on one side, and you judge the aesthetics, and both can be very different.
How many violins a year do you typically make?
About 3 or 4, not very many.
And would you usually have orders in advance for violins, or do you make them and just hope to find a buyer?
I do work on commission, so I do have a waiting list, and people first order.
And you've been doing this, I guess, for a few decades now. How has the business changed in your time making violins?
Not much. Well, we have the internet, so my wife joins me and she runs the store here, and we have an e-shop. But the actual violin making, the production of new instruments did not change much. We have some modern analysis of vibrations and of the sounds that come from violins, and we like to compare our ones to the classical ones. So the methods improved, and I think we have better understanding. But the methods of making a violin, they remain the same.
What about competition from other countries? For example, I was reading that in China today, they produce a lot of low-cost violins.
Well, the Chinese produce everything, so including violins. I try to compare myself with all the world, not only China or America, whoever. And I think the market where I belong to is not so large. There are, I don't know, a few dozens of makers who I'm comparing myself to. And I don't care whether they are from China or other countries.
Are your customers typically from the Czech Republic or from abroad?
Well, they are typically from abroad, but they are becoming more from Czech Republic.
And how do you deliver? Say, for example, somebody comes to Prague or orders online. Is there some special method you have because it's so valuable?
No special methods, but I get orders and commissions from the internet as well. Not from the e-shop, but through emails. So I sold a few violins to clients I never met.
But say, when you're actually sending them the violin, do you have to bring it by hand? Or do you know what I mean? Because it's so valuable, you can't really send it through the post.
Well, you can, but I prefer a personal delivery. So I prefer if the client comes to my shop and he picks up the violin. If this is not possible, I am also able to ship a violin, but I don't like to do that.
Have you had any bad experiences in that regard?
Not me personally, but my father had, and of course you hear about bad things happening.
You are the fourth generation in your family making violins. Do you have children? And if you do, are they in the business or planning to enter the business?
Well, yes, my son is. I think he's coming today. He's studying in England, in Newark, which is about 2 hours north of London, in a violin making school. And he still has to have to do one more year there. And he's doing fine, I think. And he's getting more and more interested, which is the greatest thing.
And how does it feel for you to be the fourth generation of your family producing violins in this great tradition?
I feel it as an advantage. In this business, it helps a lot if you have the background and if you have the tradition. So for me, it's an advantage, and I don't feel it as a burden so much. I'm just enjoying it.